Just Rory News in Paris. I'm Elena Casas.
Thank you, Elena. Welcome to our Wednesday's programme. How are you doing? Have you had a good day? A good Wednesday? It's been okay here, to be honest. It's Richie Allen, of course. Who else would it be with you live in South Manchester for Wednesday, December 12th, 2018, with what else but your Richie Allen Show.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show. It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
And I've got a very interesting guest for you this Wednesday. I often mention that I do secretly and voyeuristically watch your tweets, dear listener. I watch your tweets. Why? Why am I fishing for compliments by doing that? Not at all. I'm very interested in what you're saying about various issues because it often throws up potential guests. And I came across a lot of chatter about a doctor based in California called Dr. Robert Rowan, who is a GP, an MD, a distinguished one at that, and he's making a lot of noise about the ingredients in vaccines and why he believes vaccines might be dangerous and having adverse health effects for people. This is important. So I invited him on, he's agreed to come on, and will join us shortly, Dr. Robert Rowan. Looking forward to that. Few tweets already about it. I'll get through quite a bit with him on the programme. It's Wednesday's show. I'm live, of course, as usual, on Fab Radio 2 here in Manchester, triggerwarning.tv, TuneIn Radio, and my own website, richieallen.co.uk. Just to remind you, there is a player on the homepage of richieallen.co.uk. It's very simplistic, very sophisticated at the same time. Oxymoronic language there. It's simple but sophisticated in that it works perfectly. Never buffers, never stops, it just works. All right, so if you want to direct people to the programme, just tell them go to richieallen.co.uk and press play and they can hear the programme. I'm on Twitter, and as usual, I'll read your tweets out as we go along. Later on in the programme, I'm going to be talking to you about socialism. Yeah. Don't even think about switching off. I'll find you and I'll kick the bejesus out of you. You're not the switch off. Going to talk a little bit about socialism later on. What it means. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk about the meaning of the word. Why it's a big scary word for people. Why they don't like it. We're going to talk a bit about socialism later on, and I'll be happy to read out your abusive tweets at that particular time. Yeah, it's been a pretty decent old Wednesday today. Beavering away I was. And I had to spare a thought for my fellow producers in commercial and national media. Current affairs, TV and radio producers. Like myself. Like myself, boy, you know. Because they had the mother of all days today, Brexit. Now, you'll know that the 1922 committee confirmed earlier today that the threshold of 48 letters had been reached. And just in case you don't know and you've been working all day, that's 48 letters sent in by Conservative MPs expressing no confidence in Theresa May. Now, there will be a vote this evening. It will commence in around about 50 minutes time, 6 p.m. UK time. It'll go on till about 8 o'clock. And shortly after that, maybe half 8, maybe 9, we'll get a result. If Theresa May loses, she's a goner, but she might not lose. She might not. The TV news shows are loving this. They're presenting it with great panache. It's all very dramatic, dear listener. Theresa May needs 158 or 159 votes. They can't make their minds up to succeed, to win the day, and to carry on as leader of the Conservative Party and Prime Minister. But the networks are reporting right now, and it's approaching 8 minutes past five now, that over 165 separate MPs have already said they would support her. Now, that would be more than enough for Theresa May. But politicians are the greatest bunch of pathological liars that have ever assembled in one place. And it's a secret ballot. So some of those saying, oh, I'm voting for the Prime Minister because I'm loyal to her and I think her way is the best way. Some of those might choose to vote against her. She only needs to win by one vote. That's all. There are 317 Conservative MPs in Westminster. They all vote. So if you do the mathematics, she needs 159. Yeah. Which is half the parliamentary party plus one, I believe. She might well win. If she does, nothing changes. She might well lose. And if she does, nothing changes. So it's a win-win for those seeking to overturn the 2016 referendum result, I would argue. If she wins, she still can't get the deal she agreed with the European Union through Parliament, making her position untenable anyway. But if she wins, it's a temporary stay of execution for her. Either way, we move closer to suspension of Article 50 and a second referendum. If she loses, which seems to be unlikely right now, you have weeks of a Tory leadership contest, chaos, possibly suspension of Article 50, a possible general election for sure, and you're definitely closer to a second referendum. It's all very clever, this, by those who want to subvert the will of the people. It's very clever, very, very demonic. Demonic. Did I say demonic? Machiavellian. And I don't like to brag, but I have to brag because most of my predictions are for the birds. They end up in the toilet. I get so much wrong in terms of my predictions. But this is exactly what I predicted, strangely enough. Not that I had to be very clever to foresee this. It was always going to be the way. Theresa May and Hammond and so many of the front bench are Remainers. Most of the Labour Party are Remainers. Disgusting people like Yvette Cooper. Yvette Cooper, orange on a toothpick. Google her and you'll see what I mean. Dreadful, disgusting, anti-democratic European Union lackey. Yvette Cooper is the MP for Normanton, Pontefract and Castleford. And 70% of her constituency, believe it or not, dear listener, voted to leave. But Cooper couldn't give a shite, sold her soul. She wants to remain. Does Yvette Cooper, the other half of Ed Balls, the shit dancer that used to be front bench Labour guy, remember him? Now, hidden among the chaotic interviews today, and when I said that, I spared a thought today for producers of these television programmes. Sky and the BBC broke every conceivable record today in terms of interviews conducted in a single day. It was amazing. It was amazing. Every current or former MP, peers, business leaders, quickfire stuff. You see, they've got these makeshift gantries at Westminster surrounded by protesters, and men and women are being shuffled on for quick two-minute interviews, shuffled off, bumping into the next person up for interview. It's quite astonishing to watch it, the way it's working. And as somebody who's covered a general election or two in my time for major radio stations, I felt a bit sorry for the producers today. But hidden in all of these interviews, but not very subtly, was the refrain. The refrain oft repeated by every side, remain and leave, that we can't leave without a deal. I've lamented this time and time and again. But today, Jesus, we cannot leave with no deal. We cannot leave with no deal. Even Brexiteers are saying this. Now, the problem with that statement was brilliantly summed up by an old friend of Nigel Farage today, a guy called Michael Heaver. Michael Heaver used to advise Nigel Farage, and he explains pretty well why there is a major problem when all of the parties accept that they cannot leave with no deal. Michael Heaver.
The thing that really worries me today, though, is you've seen Philip Hammond attack Brexiteer MPs as extremists, and there's constant talking down from Philip Hammond and others in the government of no deal, attacking no deal, saying basically it isn't an option. That's why Theresa May isn't going to get anything from the European Union. If you go and negotiate, or supposedly negotiate, when the other side know you can't walk away and you won't walk away, you have nowhere to go, which is why Labour's position doesn't make much sense either. Because presumably, they've basically ruled out no deal completely as well. Presumably, if Jeremy Corbyn and Keir Starmer pitched up to Brussels and the EU said, well, we'll have £500 billion, please, or no deal, what are Labour going to do? They've completely backed the country into a corner. So we need a Brexiteer willing to walk away, willing to drive a hard bargain. There is still time, but it's time to get on the front foot, okay. Stand up for the 17.4 million and deliver that Brexit they voted for.
Michael Heaver. Incredible to be in, first of all, to put yourself into a negotiating contest with another party, which was never necessary to begin with. We should have just left. But even accepting that you were negotiating, the idea that you would take no deal off the table, basically you threw away the entirety of your leverage from the very beginning, which is what the UK government did. And what the Labour Party is saying now, and every other party, you're basically saying to the European Union, well, don't worry, no matter what happens, we won't leave without a deal. It's insane. But it's beyond insane. It's far more sinister than that. By doing that, you're accepting that, well, forevermore, we're going to have close ties with the European Union, no matter what. They can't lose. The European Union cannot lose in this scenario. If the UK was serious about walking away with no deal, the European Union would make all manner of concessions to the UK at lightning speed. At least I believe that. I think there's overwhelming evidence that would happen. Why do you say that, Richie? Some people might be crying. Well, because what we can't forget and what we've known from day one is that the European Union collectively sells more produce, more goods to the UK than the UK sells to the European Union. So it's game over. You basically say, well, look, we're leaving without a deal. Why? Because you're a bunch of arseholes. We can't get anywhere with you. 2 years we've been trying to tell you that we're leaving. No single market, no customs union. We want to do our own trade deals. And for 2 years you've been making things impossible. So, F off. We're gone. How about them apples? And at the speed of light, they would present some sort of deal. I've no doubt about that. Had a good laugh this morning, dear listener. Had a good laugh this morning. Thought of you. Alan Sugar was on Good Morning Britain with Suzanne and Piers and the other presenters whose names I don't know. Alan Sugar, Sir Alan Sugar, if you please. Wanker. The Amstrad guy who presents The Apprentice now for BBC Television. Lord Sugar, if you please, made the best possible case for supporting Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. Don't clean out your ears. Yes, I said Alan Sugar might have convinced me to support Jeremy Corbyn. Why? Well, have a listen.
You fell out of love with the Labour Party because of Jeremy Corbyn, but there is a chance here that we could trigger a general election with all this chaos, and Jeremy Corbyn could end up being Prime Minister. Oh, as a leading businessman in this country and a former Labour guy, how do you feel about that?
Well, I'll come on record here and make a statement, and as much as I hate this, if he becomes the Prime Minister of this country, I am out. I'm leaving.
The country.
Really? I will leave. Is there any bad news?
I will leave. Ooh. This country.
Seriously, I mean, people have said that before.
I will leave.
Is that a tax issue or a personality?
It's nothing to do with tax.
Brilliant question by Suzanne there. I knew that woman was worth her salt. Is it about tax, you greedy bastard? Is it, Lord Sugar? Is it about tax or is it about Jeremy? Yeah, of course, Sugar thinks it's about anti-Semitism.
I worry about my grandchildren. I worry about my grandchildren's children under this fella.
You would leave the country?
I will leave.
Under this fella, good be Jesus.
We'll leave this country.
Venezuela without the oil.
Venezuela without... That was Ian Duncan Smith, who was also on this programme, saying Venezuela without the oil. What an arsehole Smith is. Duncan Smith is. Keep Venezuela in mind. I'll be talking about Venezuela later on in the programme. Also on the sofa with Lord Sugar is Chuka Amuna. Yeah, what a beauty. You'll hear from him in a minute as well.
I mean, that's an amazing statement.
No,
someone like Lord Sugar, who's been born and bred here.
Exactly.
Built your business
here. Exactly. You couldn't sell Prosecco to a hen night. Yeah, Yeah.
You actually say you would leave the country if it was Prime Minister Corbyn.
I mean, if he was the Prime Minister of this, it would be like watching the mother-in-law drive the Ferrari over the cliff.
You sexist bastard, Sugar.
If you understand.
We haven't all got Ferrari.
He's useless. Look, Chooker, you please try and put yourself forward as the leader. Get someone else.
You've ruled out standing as leader of the Labour Party this morning, but what...
Wonderful. Let's get rid of Jeremy Corbyn and put Chuka Umunna in as head of Labour. Why not?
But what... Nigel Farage was in that seat yesterday talking about the potential to set up a new Brexit party because he's lost faith with UKIP. What about setting up a new centre-left party?
I just don't think this is the time at all.
Really?
Lots of people
are looking at this podium with a vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister thinking this is exactly the time.
I think we're in a
shut
crisis.
Shut up! Yeah, Lord Sugar says, I'll be off if Jeremy Corbyn becomes Prime Minister. Of course he won't. Corbyn probably will become Prime Minister next, probably in a coalition government with the Lib Dems and others, or maybe a minority government. That's how it's looking anyway. Shall we leave that subject for now? Shall we leave it? Let's leave it. Here's one that I tweeted today which made me giggle. A comedian has turned down a gig at a university after being asked to sign a behavioural agreement first. Yes. Konstantin Kisin. He's Russian. He's a Jewish Russian comedian. Watched a little bit of him on YouTube today. He's quite funny, actually. And he warned about a no-tolerance policy on topics and... No, hang on a second, Richie. Get the story straight now. A comedian turned down a gig at a uni after being asked to sign a behavioural agreement first. He was warned, Konstantin Kisin was warned, about a no-tolerance policy on topics including racism, sexism and transphobia. He was asked to perform at a gig at the School of African and Oriental Studies in London, which is organised by University Society UNICEF on campus. The group apologised and the students' union says it believes fully in freedom of speech, but they obviously don't because they gave him a behavioural agreement and he said it nearly made him puke, just the title alone, and they asked him, right, not to talk about several topics including racism, sexism, classism, ageism, ableism, homophobia, biphobia, transphobia, xenophobia, Islamophobia or anti-religion or anti-atheism. The contract said it doesn't mean that these topics can't be discussed, but if they are discussed, they must be discussed in a respectful and non-abusive way. This is not a joke. It's not a joke. That's the agreement they asked him to sign. He declined and they apologised. 20 minutes past the hour. I'm going to leave that one there. It doesn't need any further explanation. You know, the northeastern comic veteran of the stage, Chubby Brown, was in Manchester a couple of weeks ago. He was at the O2 Apollo in this city. I didn't go. I was tempted to go because the future Mrs. Allen was in France and I was twiddling my thumbs and I thought, will I go and watch it? And in the end, I didn't. I'd love to see how some of these students would react if they were exposed to the likes of Chubby Brown or Jim Davison. Bernard Manning is dead, of course. I wonder what they'd make of their material in 2018. I don't think they'd find it funny. Somehow. All right. Shall we have some music? Let's have some music while I get Dr. Robert Rowan on the programme. Huge interest in this. He'll be joining me live from California in a couple of minutes. And we'll be talking about, among other things, because we will talk about other things, we'll be talking about the ingredients in vaccinations. All right? That's the ingredients in vaccinations and whether or not they are harming people. Because they might very well be. In fact, I think they are. This is the Richie Allen Show, by the way. How you doing? For Wednesday, December the 12th, 2018. I am Richie Allen. Welcome to my show. Thanks for joining me, eh? Right, to give us more time with the doctor, let's cut the music short. 22 and a half minutes past the hour for Wednesday, December 12th. It is your Richie Allen Show live on Fab Radio 2. Tune in Radio triggerwarning.tv and, of course, richieallen.co.uk. Europe's most listened to independent radio show. Thanks for joining us. Massive interest in our guest this hour. And I came across a number of tweets. Vaccine injury and the safety of vaccines is a subject that we speak about quite a bit on this programme, as you know, if you're a regular listener. And I've heard from many groups around Europe, like Regret in the Republic of Ireland, of course, where I come from, and other groups of people who believe that vaccines have injured them or someone they know. And it's hugely important that we talk about this, because there is little or no discussion of this on commercial television or radio. So I was delighted to come across my next guest, my first guest. People were tweeting about him, and those tweets led me to his YouTube channel, which is terrific. It's a terrific watch. I will put out links to where you can find him on Twitter. He graduated from Johns Hopkins University back in 1971, giving away his age probably there. He's a board certified and has been recertified by the American Boards of Family Practice and Emergency Medicine. He is an MD, a GP, and this is very interesting. He is widely known as a pioneer of medical freedom, because he was very much involved in the US, in the first ever law in the US which protected alternative medicine. That happened back in 1990 in Alaska, and he's widely known for that. Let's welcome to the programme Dr. Robert Rowan. Robert, thanks so much for speaking to us today before you start work as well. Welcome to our programme. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing good. I just got out of bed.
You've just got out of bed. Isn't it funny? I was reading something about you. On one of your websites, you declared yourself not to be a morning person. And yeah, I know.
So this worked out fine. It was good. Vaccines are a hot topic, especially where I am in California. I got deeply involved in this a few years ago when my state passed a draconian law forcing children to get vaccinated no matter what, to enter school. And this caused an uprising amongst a lot of people and a lot of controversy. And in the mainstream press, you see the standard dogma. It's sort of like in 1491, the world was flat, and if you said it was round or the earth went around the sun, you could get burned at the stake. Do you understand my metaphor here?
I do indeed. I do. I know where you're going with this, sir. Go ahead.
So everyone is reading the current dogma, and it's dogma that vaccines are safe, just like everyone thought that you should get a mammogram every year. And now we're finding out that that doesn't work, that it could be dangerous. You could be much worse off. And that's just come out every year. And it just came out again this week. Women in their 40s and 50s are getting better studies than children are, because when it comes to mammography, and by the way, I'm not on Twitter, I'm on Facebook. Women, they're studying women for the long-term consequences of yearly mammograms, and they're finding out that it's probably worse than doing nothing at all. But at least they're studying them long-term. Children's vaccine studies are not long-term studies, they're very short-term studies, maybe 6 weeks, maybe a little bit longer. They only study one vaccine at a time. They're not studying them in combination. They're not studying the growing numbers that they're forcing children to get. I mean, yeah, you got my age.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
When I was growing up, I had a handful of vaccines, that's all. And now the children are in the United States are getting over 70 in the first 5 years. And these vaccines contain aluminum, which is a serious neurotoxin, an immune system deranger. And we are seeing epidemics in this country of autism, of allergies, of rheumatoid arthritis, of chronic fatigue, of ADD, and this is out of hand. And there is no study looking at the global consequences of a fully vaccinated group of children versus unvaccinated. And I believe that's mandatory, absolutely mandatory, before you go in this direction.
Robert, is it 70 now? Is that right? It's 70 in childhood, 70 shots, or not 70 yeah. shots, but maybe 20 shots with a combined 70 vaccinations. Is that right?
That's about right. And it's more than 20 shots, I think. I think 30 they're getting shots, yeah. Vaccines.
And when you were a young man, or even when you began practicing yourself back in the early 1970s, a child would have had only a handful of shots, maybe against polio, maybe against tuberculosis. Is that right?
We didn't even vaccinate against tuberculosis here. We got DPT, diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus. Now they're giving hepatitis, and hepatitis has aluminum in it. Flu vaccine has aluminum in it. DPT has aluminum in it. So these kids are getting so much more aluminum injected into them than the FDA says is safe even to take orally. Now, don't take that literally. I'm not sure exactly that, but it is an unbelievable amount of aluminum that's being injected in them. And aluminum is not that dangerous taken orally because it's a common element in the Earth's crust. So we are going to get it in our diet, but we have safeties against that. But when you inject it, it's handled totally differently. And I hear people saying to me, oh, you get much more aluminum in your diet than you do by injecting it. That's absolutely true. Well, it doesn't take much water to inhale into your lungs to die.
Right, I'm with you.
It does by drinking. It's a matter of the delivery.
Robert, can I ask you a question? Dr. Robert Rowan, MD, is live on the line from California. Now, his website is docrowen, that's rowen.com. I urge you, and I said this on my website today, if you're a parent or a parent-to-be, please have a listen to what the doctor is saying. You see, Robert, on programs like this, we often have health practitioners who are not doctors. And sometimes programs like this get criticised for not providing qualified doctors to talk about this stuff. It's wonderful to have you today because you are a doctor. And I'm urging people to listen to this. Go to docrowen.com. Doctor, are you telling me that we metabolise aluminium or aluminium in a different way if we get it injected into us? So if we swallow it through our food stuff, we actually metabolize it differently than if we get it injected. Is there something about the blood-brain barrier here?
Well, the aluminum injected is in really, really tiny particles, and it's actually to upregulate the immune system to the antigen you're injecting. But the aluminum can be taken up by your immune cells, white blood cells. They actually take it up. They don't want it there where it's injected. So they take it up, and immune cells get free passage through the blood-brain barrier into your brain. So it's like a Trojan horse. The immune cells innocently pick it up doing their job, and via a Trojan horse mechanism, it carries it into your brain because of the free passage, and it can deposit the aluminum there, and aluminum in the brain is a nightmare. It's horrible because of the inflammation it provokes. This has been studied.
You're a rare breed, aren't you? I mean, you know this. And, you know, I got 500 different questions. That's not an exaggeration. From listeners today to put to you. And, of course, we don't have time to ask 500. But many of them were saying, this is, you know, putting your head above the parapet for the doctor. Does he worry about talking about these things? Because you'll be aware of doctors in the UK, Robert, who were struck off, you know, who lost their license to practice because they suggested that ingredients in vaccines could be contributing to the epidemic of autism, of autoimmune diseases. Is it a concern for you that you might be getting yourself into trouble by talking about this stuff?
Well, first of all, it's on the package insert that these ingredients are dangerous. So you're speaking truth. And if you lose your license for speaking truth, something is wrong. Now, the concern for me would be issuing vaccine waivers. The children in our state are compelled to get vaccines unless they get a medical exemption. And I feel bad for the families, but I am turning away families and I am turning away children because there's a witch hunt here. And you know what the term witch hunt means.
Yes.
I don't want to be a victim of a witch hunt, and I can serve more people than the few children I might be able to exempt before they come knocking at my door and hauling me away to burn my license. So I am not giving exemptions, and I'm making that publicly known right now, and that's because of the witch hunt. On the other hand, there is free speech here, and all I am doing is calling out the lack of proper study on vaccines. And no one can show me. I mean, if you want to do a proper study, here's what you do. And I challenge any of these pundits, experts, to tell me that I'm wrong. Take 5,000 children or 10,000 children, and then there's plenty of them who don't want to be vaccinated, so you can get your control group. You take 10,000 children who will not be vaccinated against anything, and then you take 10,000 children whose parents believe in vaccines, and you vaccinate them for everything, and then you study them for 10 years to look at the all-cause morbidity and mortality in both groups. Now, what that means is you might well see a reduction in measles and mumps and chickenpox and everything else that I lived through, and I'm still here. You might well see a reduction in that, but what about everything else? What about the incidence of asthma, of eczema, of inflammatory bowel disease, of ADD, autism, which is in the package insert for these things? No one has done a combined study looking at all of these vaccines. One might be tolerable. But when you combine them all with all the different crap, and you look at all the different people, you know, you have different detox mechanisms than I do. Your child might have different detoxification than the next child does. No one is looking at who might be susceptible to this. And it's clear that there are vaccine injuries because in the United States, there's a vaccine court and it's handed out over $3 billion in damages. Now, tell me now that vaccines aren't dangerous when a corrupt court, and yes, I call it corrupt because you have to have evidence beyond 100%. To get a claim on this. But when you have a court like this that's set up for you to fail and it's handed out $3 billion, you know that there's something potentially wrong with vaccines.
Something smells. Something smells, yeah. Let me remind her, I've got to do this because it's a rare thing. Dr. Robert Rowan, MD, successful practitioner, working in California with a very well-known and a very popular clinic, is live on the line with us from California, and he's put his head above the parapet. His YouTube videos are fantastic. Get on there and watch them, particularly if you have children. Inform yourself. You don't have to go along with it, but at least hear the other side of it. And he's asking questions about the efficacy of vaccines, the safety of the ingredients in them. I'll try and play the devil's advocate, Robert, just for a minute. I mean, I have to. It's the right thing to do. The vaccine industry or the pharmaceutical industry, they say there's no evidence that aluminium in vaccines or that mercury in vaccines is doing any harm. That's what they say, number one. And number two, they say that this idea of a correlation between the rollout of multiple vaccinations and the autoimmune diseases you talked about, they say there is no correlation. And they say that science has become better over the decades, and we have become better at understanding autism and ADHD, and we are better able to diagnose it. They say there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that vaccines contribute or that vaccines do, show up, or that vaccines maybe give autism to children or the other autoimmune diseases that we just described. That's what they say. And of course, they're not here today because they never come on programs like this. But in the interest of fairness, they say no evidence, they say. Back to you.
All right. Well, look, that's a good question. I gave you the answer when I gave the example about mammograms. Mammograms came out in the 1970s and they pushed it real hard because they had to sell these machines to make a profit. Now, pharma got a way to make a profit when the United States Congress exempted them from lawsuits many years ago. So now they can push a product and they have no liability for it. That's why it's coming out. Now, let's go back to mammography. And this is in the news just this week.
Yeah.
Mammography now, they're saying that women should have the discretion for their own case of whether they should have mammography or not, because we're finding that it leads to unnecessary mastectomies. Women are getting their breasts chopped off for no reason, for diagnosis of cancers that go nowhere, and for scaring the bejesus out of them. So mammography has come into question 30 years after the damn thing came out. And I was against mammography 25 years ago. Look at my track record. I said something smells here. Now, vaccines are not well studied. The studies are not properly done. I told you they're done short term. They're not done in combination. They're not looking at these children over 5 or 10 years, looking at what happens to their immune system. Show me the study and I'll shut up.
Want to clarify two things. Dr. Robert Rowan is our guest. Thanks, Robert, for coming on. This is Dynamite. And by the way, my Twitter feed has gone bananas with people who are really interested in this. You said that you're not exempting patients at your clinic. You're playing fair and you're operating within the law, and that's to be commended. Are you, while not giving out exemption passes or exemption forms, are you telling your patients, look, this is what I feel. I think there might be problems with these vaccines. Is that what you're doing?
Well, I do feel that there's problems with the vaccines. By the way, my Facebook page, go to my Facebook page, not Twitter, Dr. Yeah. Robert J. Rowan, and there's a lot on there about vaccines going back in a couple of years, several years, a lot. Now, in terms of vaccine waivers, I don't think anyone would call into question issuing a waiver if a first degree relative had autism, apparently from a vaccine. In other words, if a woman brought her son in and her firstborn son got a vaccine injury, no one that I know of, including the state, is going to question the wisdom of giving an exemption to that second child. Are you with me on that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
No one will, because no one will deny that there could be a genetic propensity for these things. On the other hand, if someone just walks into the office and says, I don't want to vaccinate my child, I can't do that. And I'm not going to do it because of the witch hunt.
Right. What happens then, though?
I talk with them about it. If there's free speech, I can talk with them about it. And then they're going to have to make a decision what they want to do. A lot of women in a lot of families in California now are homeschooling their children rather than getting them forcibly vaccinated in this scheme of Russian roulette.
Yeah, you are no use to anybody if you get into trouble with the board, with the certified board in California. I think you're absolutely right. I think it's brilliant. You can't be giving out the exemptions because of the witch hunt, but at the same time, you can say to patients, look, this is what I think. Now, the onus is on the parent then, what they do with that information. And it's brilliant. It's very interesting you're talking about parents homeschooling. We have a real concern in the UK, Robert, that the state is looking to start removing children from homes where the parent has decided not to vaccinate. Is that something you're concerned about there in California?
I am very concerned about that ultimately, yes. I don't believe, this is my own opinion, I believe governments around the world, especially ours, have been hijacked by corporate interests and have forgot about the interests of the people. Our republic was founded on individual rights, not the Hitlerian method of we'll sacrifice your rights for the common good. And that's what that's what's happening right now. Your individual rights, the rights of you to raise your child and your family as you see fit, is being destroyed for the common good. And the common good is really the bottom line of corporate pharma. That's how I see it. That's why we have a system that's based on drugging symptoms instead of helping people get better by biological methods, giving them what their bodies need to heal, rather than drugging their symptoms into oblivion with chemicals, which cause more toxic effects, which requires more treatment, which is more profits for pharma.
So much to talk about. Dr. Robert Rowan is our guest. It's exactly, 16 and a half minutes, 17 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. Extraordinary stuff. He's on Facebook. There's only one Dr. Rowan on Facebook. I will tweet a direct link to your Facebook page, Robert, and a link to your website as well, which is docrowan.com. Robert practices with his wife. As I said, he's a highly reputable MD, and he's asking some questions. Some uncomfortable questions, I would imagine, for, again, those in power, at least those in power in California, when it comes to medicine. What about what's happening in Ireland? I'm an Irishman. There's no hiding it from my accent. I'm sure you've deduced that. I'm living and working in the United Kingdom now. You know, a couple of years ago, Robert, a number of women came to this programme. They formed a group called Regret, and their website is regret.ie. These are nice women. They're working women, working mothers. Some of them are stay-at-home mothers. They have teenage daughters, Robert, not in their tens or in their dozens, in their hundreds, convinced that their daughters have developed chronic fatigue symptoms or other horrible symptoms that have made their lives almost unlivable, and they are convinced there is a relationship between their symptoms, their illnesses, and the HPV vaccine Gardasil. The treatment of these girls and their parents by the Irish media has been disgraceful. By the Irish health authorities has been disgraceful. People have even accused the mothers, Robert, of being akin to child abusers. It's a disgrace. Have you followed this story, and do you have sympathy for these mothers and these girls who don't number 10 or 20 or 50, they number hundreds now, thousands around Europe, actually. What do you think?
What do I think? I'm right on. I see this crap every day. I've seen children who have been injured by Gardasil, and it's a vaccine I would never, ever, ever give, because it's not a communicable disease in the example of measles, where you can cough on somebody and get it. Now, I know they're being treated horribly. I want to give you another hard example. In the country of Australia, doctors are losing their licenses because the authorities don't believe Lyme disease exists. So you can't treat Lyme disease, and I know doctors who are terrified of the authorities for this. Yet in my country, our CDC does recognize Lyme. It's warning people about being bitten by ticks, and there's 300,000 to a million new cases every year of this. So science, how can it be science if one country says, no, it doesn't exist, and another country says, yeah, we have an epidemic? That's not science. That's lunacy. And the Gardasil vaccine has injured a lot of young girls. I know this. And by the way, we have treated vaccine-injured kids with ozone therapy, and it's remarkable what it can do. Not in everybody, but in a lot of cases. And I talk about ozone therapy on my Facebook page and also on my website.
I was going to ask you, Robert. Robert, hold your horses there, my friend. I was going to ask you, because I've been reading all about ozone therapy. I watched your videos. I'm fascinated by it. I did notice that a couple of years ago, there was a very negative article in the Telegraph newspaper, which is a broadsheet national newspaper here in the UK. There was a very negative story about ozone therapy, and it's been called pseudoscience and all the rest of it. But I'm fascinated. I want to ask you about that in a minute, if that's okay. I am mindful of the fact that you have patience and you have things to do. At any time you want to tell me to piss off, excuse my language, I will piss off and leave you alone. But it's great to have you on, and there has been a huge reaction to this. I'm sure the listeners in Ireland who are affected by Gardasil will be moved by what you just said there, you being a general practitioner, an MD, and I do want to talk about ozone therapy in a minute. You talked about measles. Talk to me about herd immunity. I find this staggering, the idea that the unvaccinated could represent a threat to the vaccinated. I'm not the brightest spark in the world, Robert. I never claimed to be. But I can't get my head around the notion that an unvaccinated child could represent a threat to people who have been vaccinated. What's that all about?
Well, it doesn't make logical sense. And you're a layman, and I'm proud and impressed that you see it. Allegedly, if vaccination gives you immunity, then your child has the bulletproof vest. Your child does have no risk. So why the hell are you turning into my child, who's not vaccinated, into some ghoul, placing your child at risk, when if anyone's at risk, it's my child, according to your logic? It doesn't make sense. It's illogical. To me, in my language, I would call that an oxymoron.
Yeah.
It's craziness. Now, I'm going to go on to something philosophical here. There are children who truly can't be vaccinated because of it. They have immune problems. They come into this world and they have problems. I'll admit to that. And I know that will be raised. And your child might be one of them. You can't get vaccinated against the measles. And if your child gets measles, it could be a calamity. Now, and I'm in agreement with that. Now, I want to use, I'm trying to talk with wisdom, spirituality, science, and practicality all at once. Do you have the right, now let's say it's your child that has this immune problem. Do you have the right to compel me to vaccinate my child and put my child at risk to protect your child? You ask that question.
Yeah.
And then I want an answer from you. If you have the power to compel me to put my kid at risk to protect yours. Now, I'm going to tell you how I feel about this. Walking across the street is a risk. I could get hit by a car. Conceiving a child is a risk. Your child could have a genetic anomaly like Down syndrome or an immune problem. That's your problem. If you decide to conceive a child and there's a problem with that child, that's your problem. You took the risk. It's your responsibility. Where do you get the right to take my child or the woman down the street, her child, and inject aluminum to them to protect your child when you're the one who's responsible and you took the risk? Something's not right here. And if we're going to think about destroying the rights of the individual for the greater good, then we have an absolutely totalitarian society. And I personally believe that's where the world is marching to because of the corrupt corporate rulers of the world. That's what I believe.
Wow. You know, I was going to suggest, I was half thinking of not asking this next question, but I'm going to ask it anyway in light of what you said. Could it be even more sinister than some people think? Could there be an agenda to make people ill? You know, I mean, I know that sounds kind of James Bond villain type stuff, and you're a doctor, you're a man of science, you might think it's ridiculous, and by all means, shoot me down. But a part of me wonders, is there something going on here? Does somebody want to make children ill and create patients of the future? Go ahead.
I've written about this on my Facebook page, and if you go back, you'll see it. The pharmaceutical industry is the greatest, I don't know what the right word is, Ponzi pyramid system in the world. Somebody, I mean, is high blood pressure a deficiency of some synthetic petrochemical pharmaceutical? Or is high blood pressure a problem of lifestyle, eating fried foods, eating a lot of meat, eating a lot of trash, not getting vegetables? If hypertension, and there's studies out there, can be treated with potassium or magnesium or certain herbs or other things, that's telling us that that person has a deficiency of these essential nutrients. And to me, it makes more sense to get what that body is asking for and to correct it than some synthetic petrochemical pharmaceutical that will create toxicity or other effects that you need other profiting chemicals to treat. So now you have the greatest pyramid system the world has ever known. Take a chemical, get toxicity, now you need more chemicals, there's more injury, and so on. Instead of addressing the cause.
Instead of dealing with the root cause. Before we talk about ozone, and any time you want to bail, by the way, this is a professional network, a syndicated radio show. It really is, but I'm quite happy. You know, if you've got to run, you can bail. But I wanted to put something to you. The Daily Mail is a national newspaper in the UK. It's a very popular paper. It does some good stuff sometimes. It puts out some good articles. Doesn't it? You know the Mail. Yeah, the Mail Online. Here's a story from yesterday. We are taking more pills than ever, and the trend shows no sign of abating. Last year, the National Health Service prescribed more than 1.1 billion items, which is double the number from 10 years ago. And that figure does not include medication dispensed in hospitals. As many as 20 prescriptions are now written per head of population each year, a rise of a third in just a decade, the Mail reported. And just before you come back in, Robert, for our listeners, there are just over 60 million people, 63 million people in the UK. And the statistics are showing that every person, all 63 whatever million, are getting 20 prescriptions a year, double in 10 years. Robert, that's insane, isn't it?
Well, let me tell you, if you go to my YouTube channel, you'll see a lot of people who are sick when they come to me. You'll see that. I have before, I have after videos. And there's a narcotic opiate crisis in this country. I think you know that as well.
Yeah.
Take a guess how many new prescriptions for opiates I've written in the last 20 years, except for a few cases of cancer. Take a guess.
Well, knowing what I know about you, having read about you and watched you, I'm guessing it's very, very, very low. You don't believe in it.
You won't even count it on the number of one hand.
Brilliant.
I don't have to write prescriptions for opiates because I go for the cause of pain. There is a crisis of drugs. Everything is based on drugs, and that's because it has to be approved. And you're not going to get anything approved by the so-called authorities unless you have, now the number is about $2 billion to get something approved so that you can formally prescribe it and it's accepted by everyone else and insurance. Now, who is going to come up with $2 billion to put vitamin C into a study or ozone into a study because it can't be patented? The system is inherently corrupt. It's inherent. It's built into the system. So more and more drugs are being prescribed and more people are getting sicker with these drugs. And that creates more and more money. Just follow the money trail.
Follow the money.
And you'll find out what's going wrong. In my practice, I do write a few prescriptions for drugs once in a while. It's not common, but there are some people with blood pressure that I just can't manage any other way. I have maybe five people like that. That's not very many. I don't write narcotics for pain. I don't have to, except a couple cases of cancer. And I have not written a prescription for an NSAID drug, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. I haven't written a prescription for that horrible class of drugs in about 25 years, maybe 30.
This is amazing, you know. It's so incredible to hear this from a GP. We say, of course, GP here in the UK, as you know. It's incredible because we are led to believe that one of the excuses doctors make in England, at least doctors who work for the NHS, one of the excuses they make is that patients come in all the time and patients expect a prescription. You know, when a patient goes to his or her doctor, they expect his or her doctor to give them a prescription.
Of course they do. And I don't mean to interrupt, but I want to give you a couple examples right out of your own country. I rarely have to write prescriptions for antibiotics. I use ozone or ultraviolet blood irradiation, and it's rare that I write prescriptions. And I can get, I've just published a case of an acute tick bite cellulitis that we cured with ozone therapy, no drugs. It was clearly a bacterial infection. I have a case of a woman with a septic prosthetic hip, which is unheard of to see resolve absent surgery to take it out or antibiotics. She got cured without surgery or intravenous antibiotics. She did get an oral antibiotic. This is the first in the world. And your own British medical journal or Lancet, I forget which one it was, refused to publish my article on curing Ebola. Yes, I went to Sierra Leone in 2014. We took ozone. We cured five cases of Ebola in a couple days. Those patients had no after effects. They got better immediately. I submitted that for publication to your journal, and they refused it, telling me, we don't think it would be of interest to our GPs.
Well, of course.
That's what it said. In the meantime, they're publishing crap on vaccines and experimental drugs for Ebola, but I took them a $5 cure, and they wouldn't publish it.
A $5 cure. And they turned you down, saying that it wasn't in the interest of the profession, it wasn't in the interest of their readers. That's disgraceful. Of course, they should have been all over that. They should have sent somebody to see you and to ask you to demonstrate it. Wow.
I haven't gotten anybody in the mainstream news to cover that, and it's published in the African Journal of Infectious Diseases, and the news media won't pick it up. I've sent it to the embassy in the DRC because there's a new Ebola epidemic. We've reached out. We've been willing, my partner and I have been willing to go back and help these people, but no one is interested.
They don't like you, Robert. This is Dr. Robert Rowan, MD, by the way. They don't like you because you're one of them, or at least you should be. You see, you're an establishment, you're a qualified, certified doctor, and they don't like this. Just before we talk about ozone, that's the next thing, because I want to ask you what it is and give us the absolute rundown on what it is. A friend of mine, Jim, is listening to this with great interest. And Jim says, Richie, ask the doctor Do natural childhood illnesses prime our immune system into fighting much greater diseases in later life? It's a brilliant question by Jim. We need to get measles and all of this stuff when we're younger to give us a great immune system later on. Is that right?
I happen to believe it does. If you scroll way back on my Facebook page, I put up an article from the New England Journal of Medicine, top tier. It was published in the early 2000s, where the author questioned our wisdom in giving vaccines, saying that the lack of these childhood illnesses seemed to impair immunity later in life. And that's why I'm calling, look, I'm trying to be honest and honorable here and not some crazy wacko. I'm saying that we need a study of 5 to 10,000 kids who do get vaccinated and 5 to 10,000 who don't. Let these kids get their diseases, and then let's take a look at their health 10 years later, 20 yeah. years later, like we did with the Framingham study on cholesterol in Massachusetts. They're studying families out generations now. We need to be doing this before we forcibly inject people with things, and we're not doing it. And yes, I do believe that getting these illnesses properly primes the immune system for a lifetime of balanced immunity, because you have plastic immunity with vaccines. You don't have real immunity. If you did, the immunity wouldn't wear off. The immunity from vaccines wears off in 10 to 15, maybe 20 years, because it's a weak immunity. It involves what's called the humoral immune system, which is antibodies. And real immunity comes from the cellular immune system, which is permanent. Now, it wouldn't bother me a bit to walk into a cloud of measles. If there was a measles room down the street, I'd walk in there and I wouldn't have any issue, because I had measles when I was a kid. But somebody who got vaccinated 25 years ago from measles could have an issue because his vaccine immunity might have waned.
I didn't know that. This is news to me. I did not know that. Somebody who took the vaccination, it's waned. Possibly it might not, but it might have. And then they might be susceptible to it now. It's tyrannical, this notion of telling people that they must be vaccinated or they can't work this job, or your child must be vaccinated or they can't go to this school. These are dreadful things. In the time we have left with Dr. Robert Rowan, MD, thanks for your time, Doc. It's an absolute honour to have you on the programme today. It really is. DocRowan.com. I'd like to ask you about ozone. What is it, Doctor? What is ozone and how has it benefited your patients? You talked about the Ebola cures, which is amazing. How has it worked for you? When did you come across it? And how do you use it on a daily basis?
I stumbled across it in 1986. I thought it was crazy at first because we were supposed to believe in antioxidants, and this is an oxidant. But I read the materials, and I just couldn't believe what I was reading. So I said I had to try this. I was living in Alaska at the time. I lived there 22 years. And with my very first patient who got better from something weird, which today we probably would call Lyme disease, I said, geez, this is amazing. Well, ozone, people come to us from around the world for this, literally around the world. I've had people from Australia, from the UK. I've had people sicker than crap with Lyme disease who couldn't function, literally couldn't function. It's on my YouTube channel. And after several treatments of this, and sometimes their brain fog clears on the first treatment, they're much better. Ozone, and I do joints like knees, our results with knees are about 85%. We're able to save them from surgery. Their knees get better from degenerative arthritis. It treats just about everything. Now, look, I'm not saying that it's a universal cure. It's the closest thing to a universal panacea we have. And the reason is that all healing is dependent upon oxygen. I'm sure you'd accept that, right?
I would. Now, of course, I'm a layman, as you pointed out quite rightly earlier on, and I've heard that from other doctors, learned men and women such as yourself. So yes, I would accept that, but I'm a layman. Go ahead.
Oxygen, oxygen, oxygen. Everything is dependent on oxygen. When you injure yourself, you disrupt the circulation, and it's slow to heal because of less oxygen because of the injury. If you have an infection, your immune cells need 50 to 100 times more oxygen to fight the invader. This is all published stuff. This is not pie in the sky yeah. stuff. Ozone is oxygen. It's O3. It's very reactive oxygen. And it has several effects. And I'll tell you some of those effects and why I decided I would risk my life and go treat Ebola. The reason is that, one, when you give ozone therapy to somebody, it increases a compound in the red cells called 2,3-DGP, which enables them to easier release their oxygen in the tissues, so you get better oxygen delivery. Two, it improves the red cells' flexibility so that they can squeeze through your tiny capillaries better. Three, it enhances mitochondrial consumption of oxygen. And I say that by a study that I can infer that that's happening, because you get a rise in oxygen delivery and you get a reduction in oxygen return to the heart. And that difference means more oxygen consumption in the tissues, which means more energy. The next effect of ozone is it has direct killing ability to pathogens. And the final effect that I use for Ebola is ozone modulates the immune system. So if your immune system is out of balance, it brings it back into balance. And with Ebola, your immune system is way out of balance because the virus doesn't kill you. Your immune system, it's called a cytokine storm, does kill you, and ozone therapy modulates that. So all these are wonderful effects for people who are diseased, because all of these wonderful effects will help almost anything out there. Now, your degree of improvement will depend upon you. I have seen people with acute infections get better like that day or the next day or within a couple days of ozone. I will combine ozone with standard antibiotic therapy if they need it. I'm not against that. I use ozone for circulation. I use it for toxicity. I've used it. I've seen a couple people with cancer do extraordinarily well with it, but that's hit and miss. And I'm not telling you it is a cure for cancer, but it is published that ozone makes sense for cancer, because if you get more oxygen to the cancer behaves less aggressively. And ozone helps you get more oxygen to it. So ozone is probably one of the best treatments that there is.
And it's inexpensive. You said earlier on, you talked about a $5 cure for Ebola. Where did this happen in Africa? Was it in the Central African Republic? Where was it exactly, Robert?
Sierra Leone, a former British colony.
Sierra Leone.
My partner and I were invited by the president of the country, and we actually met him to come and train their people with ozone. And in the midst of training them, in the middle, a call came in from the Minister of Health telling the treatment center, if you continue with the ozone process, you'll lose your job. So I felt like I was kicked in the gonads. I'm being polite here with my words.
Yeah, you don't have to be polite. We're past the watershed. Well, there is no watershed on this program. That's...
I was kicked in the balls, literally, and I lost it. I am usually even-tempered, and I lost it. And I screamed to those people. I said, this is, to me, it was an illegal order. It's basically the equivalent of genocide. I said, doctors in this room are going to die. And yes, I was right. One of the doctors I had trained to do ozone eventually got Ebola. And because they canned the project, he was denied ozone and he was hauled away in an ambulance and eventually died. Now, another doctor that I trained decided not to tell the government that he had Ebola, that he had symptoms, because he knew that if he did, he'd be thrown in the tank, and then he had a 60% chance of dying. So he went to our people, got ozone, and recovered in 48 hours. How about that? Another
it's very frustrating. Do you know, Robert, it's very frustrating to hear this, particularly because when I speak to people, I don't speak to people like you very often. Like I said earlier on, I don't get so many GPs or MDs on. We do get some, but not very many. It's often alternative health practitioners, people whom I vetted very hard before inviting on. And, you know, it's when we bring people on to talk about alternative remedies or alternative ways to treat things, some of our skeptical listeners, they say, oh, this is pseudoscience, they say, and it's snake oil. They say that some of these people are, they're basically trying to empty your pockets, they're greedy, they're selling you snake oil. But this is not the case.
Are you telling me the pharma's not trying to empty your pockets?
Well, that's right. Yes. How ironic. Of course. And I make that point all the time. I say, look, how ironic. But ozone is, it's very, very affordable, this, isn't it? You mentioned earlier on a few bucks for people to get access to it. Talk to me about the affordability of it, the practicality of people treating themselves with this.
All right, let me. I'll get to that after I tell you what happened with Ebola.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
About a year ago, a doctor in South Africa who had inside connections told me what happened in Sierra Leone. He told me that he found out that the World Health Organization went to the government of Sierra Leone as the pimp for pharma and told the government, if you don't stop the ozone project, the pharma will not only pull out of your country, Sierra Leone, but out of all of Africa.
Shut down, basically.
Yes. So, in my opinion, lives were traded for profit. That's my opinion. Merck Company murdered over 100, and I use that word carefully. Merck knew Vioxx was killing people, and it kept it on the market for profit until it was finally pulled after over 110,000 American deaths. Now, to me, that's murder because they knew it was killing people and they were making money on it. So let's get back to ozone. Ozone can be dirt cheap and it can be rather expensive. It depends how you give it. In third world countries, it's generally given by direct intravenous gas injection where you actually inject the gas into the vein. Now, most of the seasoned ozone doctors don't like to do this because there are a few problems with it. It can be hard on veins. It can cause coughing and some chest discomfort. So most seasoned doctors in the Western world don't like this, and they talk down about it. And that's fine. I accept that. I don't typically do that method. But for Sierra Leone, where you don't have sophisticated machines and equipment, and there's a risk of major contamination with Ebola, a 27-gauge butterfly needle in a syringe is the only thing you need to treat them. And you can use the same syringe over and over again, so it costs less than $5 to treat somebody with this method. Now, if you're using the better methods called major autohemotherapy or hyperbaric ozone, now you need sophisticated, more expensive machines, and you need equipment that requires medical disposal. So the price goes up. And in the third world, I would say like in India, where they're doing this, you can get the direct intravenous gas for as little as a couple dollars. And in other countries, like Western countries, you can get the better form of ozone for anywhere between maybe $100 US, and you could get the best form, which is a massive amount of ozone. They can cost several hundred US dollars.
Compared to some of the figures that they throw around about oncology and cancer treatments here in the UK, it still sounds relatively cheap by comparison. And I suppose if GP surgeries were to have the machines, they could offset the price of the machines across treating many patients and bring the price right down, right? It makes sense to me.
If you introduced ozone therapy into the British system, you would have a revolution in real health. Instead of it being disease maintenance, we don't have a health system. We have a disease maintenance system. You would stop that and you would see people being returned to health where they wouldn't need all these 20 drugs per person that you're talking about. It's not just ozone. I have three mantras. My mantras for getting somebody well are to deal with the three biggies: improper nutrition, toxins, and stress. To me, vaccines are a major toxin in a lot of people. All people are nutritionally deficient because they're eating a crummy diet. Yeah. My mantra is, if God didn't make it, don't eat it. That's my mantra, and that's how I live my life. So we're dealing with improper nutrition, toxins, and stress. And pharma's answer to it is synthetic, petrochemical, patented, pharmaceutical, profit-making drugs. And that's all we get because they own the system.
And you can go to Sierra Leone and you can document the efficiency of ozone. And I've read quite a bit about it. Like I said, in the interest of balance, there was an article in the Telegraph here a couple of years ago claiming to debunk it and saying it was pseudoscience and saying it was dangerous. People can read that if they want. That's democracy. Listen to Dr. Robert Rowan speaking about ozone here. But go and read the Telegraph article as well. But I'm fascinated by this. I'm going to...
Let me tell you this.
Go ahead.
True story. I emailed the Telegraph. I emailed the Mirror. I let them know about this. One of your nurses, a UK nurse, came back from West Africa with Ebola, and they were fearful that she would die. I reached out to the doctor in the hospital about the article. I was willing to even fly over there and treat her.
Nothing.
I think her name was McCafferty or something like that.
You're right.
She did survive, thank God, but I'm just letting you know that I was willing to do this.
How frustrating is that? You talked about $2 billion spent on getting a drug to market. You and others, not just you, but other learned men and women, swear by the efficiency and the safety, the non-side effect, which is obviously hugely important, ozone, and yet you can't get a look in. You sent documentation to The Lancet. You invited them to take a look at it. That's, of course, a very famous medical journal. And they basically told you to get stuffed, go away. How frustrating is that, Robert?
I have to admit, it is frustrating. It's hard. It's hard when you have something that could help so many people that is without risk, without toxicity, and is dirt cheap. And it could help so many people, and the system just won't look at it. JAMA describes that. And it's in one of my latest articles. You could go to PubMed and type in the word Rowan and ozone, and you'll see several articles that I've recently published in mainstream journals. Well, JAMA published something years ago by an author named Goodwin, who called it the tomato effect. So the tomato effect is describing a therapy that is working, that works, that could be phenomenal, but no one gives it the time of day because no one believes that it could work. That's the tomato effect, and ozone suffers from it.
I've got to mention one last thing before we part company today, and it's been a tonic. It has been a tonic having you on, speaking to you today. But David Noakes has been on this program several times, and I think David is very honest. He's been sent to prison for 6 months. He was manufacturing and selling GC math, and maybe he wasn't doing it properly, maybe he didn't box clever, but I know that he absolutely believed, regardless of whether he was right or not, he believed in GC math and that it was helpful and that it was useful in treating various things. And he would say that, what he would echo what you said earlier on, that some very powerful interests were influential in getting him shut down. Now, the judge did say in the court case that after a time period, money did become the motivation for David. I did put those questions to him when I interviewed him myself before he went to prison. But I'm inclined to believe that there are a lot of things that have been developed, natural things, by people like yourself, Robert, and others, that are being kept from people. There's no doubt in my mind that the influence of Big Pharma in this country, in Ireland and in Europe, through the European Union, through the World Health Organization, which is a revolving door for Big Pharma, I have no doubt that they are working night and day to prevent people from looking closely at ozone and other things. I have no doubt about that. Do you know, it's been brilliant having you on the programme today, Robert. I'm going to give you the final word. Before I do, though, I'm going to recommend that people find you on Facebook. I will put a link to it on my Twitter, and I will put a link to it on my website, where they can find you on Facebook. But you can also find out more about Robert on YouTube. Just look for Dr. Robert Rowan on YouTube. You'll find him. And the website is docrowan.com. Thanks for coming on and speaking to us today, giving us your time, Robert. I really enjoyed listening to you. I'll give you the final word. Before you have that final word, I want to wish you and yours a Merry Christmas and a prosperous New Year. Final word to you, sir. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. My advice for diet, if God didn't make it, don't eat it. And please go to somebody who can help you look for causes for your problem. No one was born with a deficiency of a synthetic petrochemical pharmaceutical drug. When you find someone who is, I'll write the prescription for it. I've never seen it.
Robert, brilliant stuff. Thanks a lot. Please come back again in the new year. It'd be great to have you back. Maybe do a question and answer segment with our audience if you had the time to spare. Thanks again. Look after yourself and Merry Christmas. Bye for now.
Thank you.
Brilliant stuff. Thank you. The amazing Dr. Robert Rowan, live on the Richie Allen Show for Wednesday, December 12th, 2018. Music from The Corrs, back with your reaction next. Say it's true. Great tunes, never get old. The Corrs and Runaway on the Richie Allen Show. 21 minutes past the hour. Live from Manchester. Do me a favour and check out Gemma O'Doherty on YouTube. If you haven't done so, Irish journalist, terrific woman, is doing Google Hangouts live through YouTube. And she's got an amazing array of men and women talking about things that you don't hear on commercial or national media. You know all about Gemma. She's been on this programme. I think she's doing a terrific job there. That's not to patronise her. It's really good. It's really watchable. And she's got some amazing men and women. Garrodo Colmón was on with her yesterday. I know she's got a live stream coming up a little bit later on this evening as well. She normally goes on around about 8:30, 9 p.m. Check out Gemma if you haven't done before. She's one of us. By one of us, I mean she's a Paddy. And she's doing a terrific job and a welcome addition, that is, to the independent media. Loads of comments on Robert. And I've had a couple of private messages from people connected to Gardasil and HPV in Ireland. And they were cheered up, to hear him talking about it. And I suppose, no pun intended, but it's very regretful, I suppose, for people in Ireland that there are no GPs in Ireland. At least I don't know of any. There might have been one, actually. I might have had one GP from Ireland on the programme. But there aren't many GPs in Ireland who are saying, yes, there is a big problem with Gardasil. You heard Robert Rowan, MD, clearly say there he would not give Gardasil to any of his teenage patients, any of the girls, or even the boys, of course, because they want to roll this out for boys now as well. Let me read some tweets. So many came in while I was speaking with Robert there. He is going to come back and speak to us in the new year and do a question and answer on all manner of medical issues, right? So he will do that. Number of you talking about Nestle. Number of you talking about Merck and Vioxx. Yes, these companies have been exposed in the past, in the recent past, and have had to pay billions in compensation for drugs that made it to marketplace and then damaged or injured people. This is not new. Glaxo had to settle a billion-dollar lawsuit for bribing doctors with concert tickets, with cars, with dinners in fancy restaurants, with holidays to prescribe their toxic shite. Yes, it's all true. And one of the things that people don't take into consideration is these multinational, mega gigantic pharmaceutical companies, one of the things these bastards do is they do their testing in some of the poorest countries in the world. They are rotten bastards. They go to the poorest countries and they say to people with nothing, we'll give you $20 a day if you'll take part in a controlled experiment, a controlled study of this drug, a controlled trial. That's what they do. It doesn't get any more evil. They don't trial these drugs on American people. No, they go to, as I said, Outer Mongolia. Well, they don't go to Outer Mongolia, but they go to third world countries. And they say, here, test this poisonous shit. And by the way, sign this form so that you get $20 a day, but you can never sue us if it goes wrong. It's unbelievable what they get away with. It really is. Moinga tweets, I can't wait to listen to Robert again because I need to process the gems that he just dropped on us there. Hi to Mark, Spirit Samba. It is a massive scam. Big Pharma makes billions out of statin drugs. And again, what is totally illogical to me is that people are still getting statins despite the Mail Online, not just the Mail Online, but the Telegraph, which we mentioned earlier, publishing studies only 3-4 years ago to say that statins are bollocks. They don't work. They don't work. And I think the Daily Mail even had a quote from a doctor, a revered doctor, who said that high cholesterol or cholesterol is a widely misunderstood thing. That sometimes having elevated cholesterol levels is not the worst thing in the world, apparently. I do remember reading that. Don't take my word for it now. Check it out. In This Together on Twitter. Good evening. @_InThisTogether. I prefer you use at least a pseudonym, you know. It's easier to say Billy Says, you know. But he says that when David Noakes looked the judge in the eye and said that he would do it again to save lives, that told me a lot about the man. Whatever else he may have said, Richie, I agree with that. And I said earlier, and I mean it, I believe that David Noakes believes passionately that GC math works, but he didn't box clever. And I said this to David when I interviewed him. The system is the system. You know, there are ways of going around it. You don't go through it. And he put himself in a position where of jeopardy. And he's in prison because of it. Don't think I'm not sympathetic. I am. I like David. He doesn't belong in prison at all. But that's the way the system is. Delwright tweets, Richie, my ancestors are from Sierra Leone. I remember when the Scottish nurse came back with Ebola, but she didn't declare she was unwell. When she did realise she might have Ebola, she went into hospital and within 3 days she was using the iPad and everything was fine, says Delroy. That's interesting. Do you remember the story? I remember it well. Hi to Ricky Emmett. Hi to David, cartoon drunk on Twitter. Hi to Phoenix on Twitter. Massive amount of tweets came in. I'm sorry I didn't get to them all. Hi to Susan, to Faisal. Hi to Derek. Hi to Ruth. Again, if you want to see what people are tweeting to me, go to twitter.com where it says search Twitter, just put Richie Allen Show in all one word, then you'll see all the tweets that I get. Hi to Andy Newman. Sorry David, you asked about Hawthorne Berry and you wanted me to put that to Robert. If I had seen that, mate, I would have put that point to him. On Ozone, David Stanford tweets, Anthony Kiedis. Is it Kiedis or Kiedis? K-I-E-D-I-S. Anthony Kiedis or Kiedis swears by Ozone and swears that it cured him of hepatitis C. Do send me a link to that, mate. I'll have a read of that. I'll be very interested in that as well. Point to Paul Craven. Very glad to hear Robert Rowan on the programme, Richie. He says, nobody else is doing that. That's not true, mate, but thanks for the compliment. There are plenty of other programmes trying to give platforms to people like Robert Rowan, MD. It's not just this one. There are plenty of people out there trying to do it. There's no doubt about it. We know we're not going to hear Robert Rowan, MD, on BBC television anytime soon, are we? We know that for a fact. Let's have a quick look at the BBC website, folks. Because if you're joining the programme late, Theresa May found out this morning over her cornflakes that 48 letters at least had been sent to the 1922 committee. What does that mean? Well, it means that it triggers a vote of confidence in her leadership. That's what's happened. And that is ongoing right now. It will take place, it has begun at 6 p.m. UK time. It will go on till about 8 p.m. UK time. And we are told that sometime between maybe 8:30 and 9 p.m. we will have a result and we will know whether or not Theresa May remains as the leader of the Conservative Party and ergo the Prime Minister. What are they saying? Well, I'll tell you what they're saying. We can bring up some of it now. Bear with me. This is live, you know. It is live. It is live. The BBC are reporting that the Welsh Tory MP contingent are most likely to vote for Theresa May. I think she needs to get 159 votes out of 317 Tory MPs to win. She only needs to win by one vote. Apparently, as we were approaching airtime here on this programme, it was being suggested that she already had 165. So she is favourite with the bookmakers to win the day. But as I suggested earlier on, it doesn't matter whether she does or doesn't. It's chaos all the way. And we're marching towards a second referendum and a possible general election anyway, which might return a coalition government with Labour leading it. That's how I see it. I don't know. May needs to secure 159 votes, says the BBC, which I just told you. Voting has begun and we might get a result earlier than 8:30 is what they're saying. A lot of people watching this with great interest. As soon as I know, you'll know, but I won't know anything because I'm on air till the top of the hour and no later, of course. So as soon as I know, you'll know before I know, probably. That's the way it is. Richard has sent a link to Dr. Rowan's paper. I'll retweet that, Richard Angelis. Thanks very much. I appreciate that. And he says, Richard Angela says, Rowan is brilliant. I introduced him to someone studying medicine at a British university, a first year freshman. More the tenor for future shows. He says, more the tenor. What does that mean? You've probably, that's a typo there. Probably you want to get, he will be back on. He's agreed to come back on and do a question and answer session in the future. In This Together, his name is Ian. Ian, and his picture, his avatar, is really him. Now, you know what I wanted to do in the second hour? See, I thought Rowan would be done by the top of the hour or by probably 5 minutes past, 10 minutes past six, but he hasn't been. I wanted to talk about socialism, which is a dirty word for a lot of people. And I wanted to talk about the history of socialism and why socialism is incompatible with membership of the European Union. I'm very passionate about this, and I know I've talked about it before, and I don't want to bore the arse off you. I don't. Maybe I do sometimes, but I don't want to. But I wanted to talk about it specifically, but I'm not going to do it now because I'm kind of running out of... Well, I'm not running out of time, but I wanted a good 45 minutes on it, so I can't do that. But maybe I'll do it tomorrow. I wanted to talk about the European Union. And I wanted to talk about traditional socialism. Excuse me, socialism of the past. Because one of my guests this week, Max Egan, in fact, speaking last night, talked about socialism and how... No, who was it? It wasn't Max, was it? No, it wasn't Max. No. This is what happens to you, you see, when you spend hours and hours and hours locked in a small room making a radio show. Now, I mentioned Gemma O'Doherty earlier, and I mentioned that she interviewed the Irish journalist Gerard O'Colmon, who's now living in Paris. He's been in this on this programme a few times. Very good. Very worthwhile having a listen to Gerard, as is Gemma. I mentioned, check out Gemma's programme. And he spoke very eloquently on her programme last night on her live stream, which goes out several times a week now on her YouTube channel. And he talked about the old left in France and how being a member of the left, being on the left politically, how they would have laughed at you if you called them racist. So when they were complaining about the influx of Algerian economic migrants into the country, not always economic migrants, sometimes Algerian refugees. It's had a fractious, of course, history, that region, that part of the world. But if you said to a French lefty back in the day, you're a racist for complaining about the immigration, because the left used to complain about the effect of that immigration on jobs, on conditions in jobs, and on manufacturing, and, as I said, the ability to get a job. So if you complained about that, you would never have been called a racist in the past. But the left, as it used to be, is not the left as it is now. And this is a point that Gerard O'Colmon made very eloquently to Gemma O'Doherty last night. And I wanted to explore this today. This notion that if you are concerned about the effects of economic migration on your situation, well, today in 2018, somebody claiming to be on the left will call you a racist. They will say you are xenophobic. They will say that you are, you know, bit of a NIMBY, not in my backyard. And it's complete bollocks. And as a history graduate, as a student of history, it was brilliant to hear Gerard O'Colmon talking about this last night. Max Egan has spoken about it with me in the past as well. It isn't racist. It isn't xenophobic. It isn't hostile towards ethnic minorities. To ask, well, who's behind this influx of economic migrants from Eastern Europe, from Poland and from Romania and elsewhere? What has it done to jobs in the UK? Has it driven down wages? Has it done? Well, it has. What has it done for the ability of people to get jobs, to get low-paid, semi-skilled jobs? What has it done for them? Can we talk about that? Now, there was a time in the not-too-distant past when you could openly talk about that, and it was so-called socialists who actually said, yes, it's not good. It's not good. There was a time when Jeremy Corbyn, the pretender, because Jeremy Corbyn is no more a socialist than Genghis Khan was. What a bastard, Richie, comparing Corbyn to Genghis. No, I'm not comparing him to Genghis Khan. I'm saying he's not a socialist. But there was a time when Corbyn and MacDonald and their pals would have criticised the European Union, would have criticised free movement because of what it did to indigenous communities and their prospects of prosperity, right? Right. Anyway, I was going to get into that in great detail. Oh, you did a little bit, Richie, on the programme tonight, but I'm not going to. I'm going to wait and get into it maybe on tomorrow's show or maybe on Friday, because it will be on Friday in lieu of my absence Monday. This week, of course, I wasn't on Monday. Right, keep those tweets coming in. A lot more have come in. I'll read them out in a minute. We'll have I'm going to take some more music. When we hear the music, we'll come back. We'll have the headlines from FSN News. We'll see, is there any news out of Westminster? I'll read more tweets, of course, and we'll move on from there. All right, all right. The Twitter handle, by the way, in case you don't know, is at Richie Allen Show. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Couldn't be simpler. That's the Twitter handle. Retro in terms of music this evening. Don't forget, by the way, check out triggerwarning.tv and check out the Trigger Warning Show and the Live Leak Show presented by Graham Booth and Hayden Hewitt. You'll find all the details at triggerwarning.tv. Right, I know I've cut the music short. Gloria Estefan and Bad Boys. Gloria Estefan. Socialism is defined in the dictionary. We will talk about socialism for a minute. It's defined in the dictionary. I know there are more than one. There is more than one dictionary, but a dictionary has defined it as a political and economic theory of social organisation, which advocates that the means of production, distribution and exchange should be owned or regulated by the community as a whole. What's wrong with that? It's also been described, socialism, as the ways of making a living, or that the ways of making a living should be owned by society as a whole, meaning the value made belongs to everyone in that society instead of a group of private owners. And if you believe that, you have been given the label socialist. You're a socialist. Right? Right. Often people who say they believe in socialism are asked, do you believe in private property? It's like a way to try and trip them up. Because if you believe in a political and economic theory of social organisation, advocates that the means of production, distribution and exchange should be owned or regulated by the community as a whole, people think if you believe in that, that you must not believe in private property. That is monumental bollocks. People should have, every human being on planet Earth should have their own land, tract of land. Monty Python and the Holy Grail. A tract of land. They should have their own land and the means to build their own house. That's what I believe. But the political and economic theory of the means of production, distribution and exchange being owned by the community, that's never been tried anywhere in my lifetime, except Venezuela. In my lifetime. I'm not saying it hasn't happened historically. There isn't a Western democracy that has adopted that system in my lifetime. Right? The world's resources. Because I was asked in an email once, and I tried to give Cliff Notes type explanations for this sort of thing. The world is bountiful, and it contains, the earth contains infinite, but an abundance of natural resources, which were claimed for themselves by kings and queens and by the financial elites, right? That's what's happened. Now, leave your rage to one side, because I get a lot of liberals and I get a lot of conservatives who listen to this programme, and I love you and you're welcome to the programme, by the way. Leave your rage to the side for a minute. The earth is bountiful and provided wonderful resources, claimed, robbed, stolen, pilfered by kings, queens and financial elites, and rented to the public or to the people for exorbitant profit. So that's how the tiny few controls the many. Like I said, it's the Cliff Notes, right? That's psychotic, right? People will tell you that the community as a whole owning the means of production and distribution is lunacy. They'll tell you that. But they don't think it's lunacy that kings, queens, earls, princes and financial elites commandeered the bounties of the earth for themselves and then sold them back to me and you. That's not lunacy, no. It's psychotic, right? So I say to people, leave the labels to one side. Labels like socialist, communist, humanist, egalitarian, conservative, libertarian, leave them to one side. Why? Because those labels were attached to ideas to make it easier to demonise those ideas. And not only that, but to pigeonhole anyone who would advocate those ideas. That's what the elite wants to do. Wants to pigeonhole and demonise any idea that might work, but particularly socialism. Demonise it. And with labels, it's very easy to do so. Leave labels to one side and your long-held opinions. Why should a man or a woman or a corporation take ownership of the world's most vital resources? Why? They didn't manufacture them. They didn't invent them. And most importantly, they didn't find them. They were always there. Water was always there. Coal was always there. Oil was always there, as was natural gas. Why shouldn't every man, woman and child on planet Earth benefit from the Earth without having to go into debt to do so? Debt to a tiny minority. Very tiny minority. It's fucking psychotic, isn't it? The greatest lie ever told. Everyone is born equal and has a fair chance to compete. Bollocks. The harder you work, the more you succeed and the more you'll prosper. Bollocks. The American dream. Bollocks in the extreme. Utter extreme. It is lunacy to live in the manner with which we live. The idea that, oh, that guy over there, he has everything because, well, he's just a bit smarter and he worked harder. Fuck off. It isn't because he's smarter and he worked harder. It's because of corruption, malfeasance and criminality that he owns everything or most things. Capitalism, my arse. Madness to live like that. Madness. Oh, I found all this oil. No, you didn't. It was always there. You have no domain over it. But corrupt kings, queens, earls and financial elites gave you domain over it when it should be used for everybody. There is enough on planet Earth for all 7 billion of us and more to have our own home, our own cars, our own gardens and fields with vegetables growing in them and everything else, if we were to choose to live like that. Madness. Never been tried anywhere. Ever. In history. The ideas have been corrupted by people, of course. Of course. And governments, Eastern Europe, other parts of the world, the ideology has been corrupted and perverted. Today we're told that socialists exist. Jeremy Corbyn, we're told, is a socialist. When I hear the words Jeremy and Corbyn and socialist in the same sentence, I want to puke my fucking guts up. Because he never was and never will be a socialist. Ever in his life will he be. Socialism is incompatible with borrowing money that doesn't exist from banks that don't have it, that invented out of thin air. You know, I've said this a million times. You cannot be a socialist and believe in borrowing from a central bank to fund your programs of government. You cannot be a socialist. Incompatible. Socialism is incompatible with membership of the European Union, which takes power away from the criminals in your own country and gives it to criminals in Brussels. That's all it does. So your struggle, the eternal struggle of the proletariat, of the workers, it's hard enough anyway if power resides with the criminals in Downing Street. Hard enough to wrestle it back from them. But giving it to Brussels makes it nigh on impossible. So socialism is incompatible with membership of the European Union. There are no socialists. There isn't a socialist alive today in government anywhere. A genuine socialist. There isn't. The last one was a guy called Hugo Chavez. Do you want to hear a bit about Hugo Chavez? I made a programme last year. 18 months ago, I made a programme, which I've edited out a few minutes of, where I talked extensively about Hugo Chavez. And I left out all hyperbole. I left out all mythology. I left out all conjecture. And I just gave you the truth about what Hugo Chavez managed to achieve in Venezuela. Do you want to hear just a smidgen of it? Why not? Hugo Chavez, the nemesis of several recent US presidents until he died of cancer a couple of years ago. He started what we know today as the Bolivarian Revolution. Do you know anything about that? I'm guessing the majority of our listeners won't. And it's not because you're stupid. Far from it. It's because nobody talks about it. What is the Bolivarian or the Bolivarian, Bolivarian Revolution? What is it? Well, it's named after Simon Bolivar. Now, he was a 19th century Venezuelan revolutionary leader, and he played a massive, massive part in liberating much of South America from Spanish rule. Huge hero of Marxists, of socialists. What did Chavez do? Now, I'm assuming that you know the basics about Chavez. If not, we'll give you the Cliff Notes version in a minute. But during Chavez's time as president of Venezuela, he used the money from the sale of oil to fund what he called Bolivarian missions. What were they? Well, it was the government using the revenue from the sale of oil to put in anti-poverty initiatives, building thousands of free medical clinics for the poor, promoting indigenous rights, building schools, putting educational campaigns in place, and giving food and housing subsidies to the poorest people in Venezuela. The opposite of austerity. Now, I want you to think about that. I want you to keep that in your mind. He inherited the country. And again, look, before we continue with this, I'm assuming you know the Chavez story. You know, from his time in the army, his attempted coup. He attempted to overthrow the government in 1992. He failed. He was chucked in jail, of course. Spent a couple of years in jail. They probably should have executed him. They probably wish they did. When he came out, he entered politics. You know all about this, right? The coup attempt. Why, as a senior member of the military, did he try to throw out the Carlos Andres Perez government? Why did he try to do that? Well, and I don't write any of this down now. I've just got key bullet points. I want to explain this in a way that I don't give you any incorrect information. Carlos Andres Perez, at the beginning of his second term as president, 88-89, he basically handed Venezuela over to the International Monetary Fund. How did he do that? Well, he accepted something called the Washington Consensus, which was a proposal which gave Venezuela a loan of $4.5 billion. It didn't need the money because it was oil rich. But because of corruption, collusion with puppets of the US government, the country had basically been sold out. What was really annoying about this is, in the 1988 presidential election, the president, Carlos Andres Perez, had called the IMF a neutron bomb that killed people but left buildings standing. And he said that World Bank economists were genocide workers in the pay of economic totalitarianism. So this guy had basically done the mother of all flip-flops and sold the country down the river to the International Monetary Fund. He sold the country to the Rothschilds, effectively. This is what he did. Chavez wasn't having any of it and attempted to overthrow the guy in 1992. I'm sure you know all about it. You can look it up and see what happened. Right, the country was on its arse. The cost of petrol and oil to consumers within Venezuela gone through the roof in a country that had massive oil wealth. Right? This is why we had the failed coup attempt by Chavez in 1992. So he came out of prison, formed a political party, and he won the presidency in 1998. You will remember the US backed a failed coup attempt against Chavez in 2002. The US failed to get rid of him. And what happened after that was truly and utterly historic. So what happened after that? What happened in the period after the failed coup against Chavez up until the present day? Well, and again, we're dealing with facts here. We're not dealing with the opinion of this researcher, I should say this broadcaster. This is fact. What he did was, Chavez, was he nationalized key industries in Venezuela. And he created something called participatory democratic communal councils. And he put in those social programs that I talked about a few minutes ago, these Bolivarian programs. Venezuela was getting massive oil profits, profits that used to go to Wall Street companies. He started investing these profits in the state and in the poorest areas of the country. This is all true, which saw massive, I can't say it enough, improvements in poverty, in getting people out of poverty, literacy, income equality and quality of life. So he was a massive thorn in the side of the World Bank and the IMF. He was a genius. In my opinion, one of the greatest men that ever lived. In my opinion. So I'm summarising here. It's a bit of a Cliff Notes version of events, isn't it? But it's all true. So as well as doing this, as well as nationalising and kicking out the cartels, the IMF-controlled cartels, as well as doing that, well, he went even further than they ever expected. He started to befriend Morales in Bolivia and Correa in Ecuador, Ortega in Nicaragua. Alliances were being formed by these people against Rothschild-controlled US corporate imperialism. He was uniting the continent, Chavez. Not in a kind of an EU-type way. There was no political union going to come out of this with a single government dictating to the entire continent what went and what didn't went or what didn't go, right? There was none of that. It wasn't going to be a tyrannical political union. These countries would remain independent and would be totally sovereign and break the shackles of the IMF and the World Bank. The Rothschilds. But they would cooperate in a way that would benefit the, dare I say it, the proletariat. I put that in because if I keep this going, I'm going to say comrade at some stage, right? There are going to be people listening to this program. We're not going to like this, but I don't care. This is how I see it, and this is the truth. I'm not going to start using words like comrade. So Chavez was a vehement anti-Zionist, of course, and for years he was labelled anti-Semitic because that's what these people do when they're... hegemony is threatened. He's an anti-Semite, of course, eh? So basically what happened, under the privatisations mandated by the International Monetary Fund and carried out by Chavez's predecessor, life in Venezuela was unlivable during the 1990s. Garbage couldn't be collected. Electricity would go off for weeks and weeks and weeks because private companies with their head offices in the US ran electricity supply in these countries and would switch off the power. The country was a corporatocracy. It was owned wholesale by some of the biggest corporations in the world. Chavez said no more. No fricking, as David would say, more. It's going to stop. No more Venezuelan oil profits going to Wall Street corporations. No way. They would be invested in the people of Venezuela. You see, they couldn't buy this guy. Several times after Chavez came to power in 1998, they attempted to buy this guy. They attempted, but this guy must want what everybody else wants. Riches, money, title, power, castles, properties overseas. No. Chavez invested the now nationalized state oil resources in the people of Venezuela. Millions of people came out of poverty, all true, and wait for it. In the period between 1995 and 2009, he halved poverty and unemployment in Venezuela. That is the truth. It's not a made-up stat. The guy was the real deal. I was thinking today, how do you describe him? I was thinking he was Tony Benn on steroids. Way beyond Tony Benn. And it's my biggest regret. I secured an interview with him in 2009, I think. Late 2009. But his English wasn't good enough for an interview. And just when we were about to do it, there was a problem with the interpreter and we couldn't do it. And he was really keen to do it. I was gutted. Tony Benn on steroids. So he died of cancer. I believe he was murdered. He said that he was, you know, that they had induced the illness in him. And the current president, Nicolas Maduro, under fire today from the world's media, has continued with the Bolivarian or Bolivarian programs. He has. And that was 18 months ago, that little segment there from a Sunday View back in June of last year. And we know the unbelievable pressure that Maduro and the Venezuelan government has come under as the empire has struck back. Look, we've got to leave it there. Big shout out to Dr. Robert Rowan, MD, who was on the programme live from California earlier on. Amazing man. Delighted to have him on the show. This programme will be online real soon on Podomatic, iTunes and Spotify, and it'll be on YouTube in its entirety, minus the music, in about 2 hours' time. Going to leave you with some Neil Young, closing out Wednesday's programme. Thanks for listening to it. Look after yourselves and one another. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday. I've been Richie Allen. Speak to you tomorrow, Thursday, at 5 p.m. as usual. Bye for now.